Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the proof of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin that just emerged, which Andrew Weissman, the number two in charge of the Mueller report, now characterizes as the smoking gun that they were looking for. Weissman went on to remark that this intelligence was in the hands of the Trump administration during their investigation and was held back from Mueller. Joining us is Mark Lowenthal, President Emeritus of the Intelligence and Security Academy, who was Assistant Director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, Vice Chairman for Evaluation on the National Intelligence Council, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence, and Staff Director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. We'll look into the possibility of more evidence of Trump-Russia collusion leaking out and the announcement by the Biden White House that the intelligence community was not unanimous in its conclusions that Russian intelligence paid bounties to the Taliban to kill Americans. The evidence was not considered sufficient to sanction individuals based on detainee interrogations of members of a criminal militant network linked to the Taliban, whose leader, Rahmatullah Azizi, fled to Russia allegedly on a passport provided by the GRU. Then we'll assess the piling on by right-wing media and the anti-vaxxing movement over the pause in the Johnson & Johnson vaccinations based on six people getting blood clots out of 7 million who received doses. Naomi Oreskes, a professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary science at Harvard University, and author of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming, and Why Trust Science, joins us. We'll discuss the Republican attack on science and data laid bare by Congressman Jim Jordan's manic interrogation of Dr. Fauci over when we would get our liberty back, even though liberty in America is now endangering life and the pursuit of happiness. Then finally, we'll speak with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, Professor of History and Italian Studies at New York University, whose latest book is Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. She joins us to discuss her article at CNN, The New Lies of the GOP and Tucker Carlson, who, as the top-rated propagandist on Fox News, is mainstreaming the racist replacement theory heard at the anti-Semitic Tiki Torch March from the neo-Nazis at Charlottesville, chanting, "The Jews will not replace us." And joining us now is Mark Lowenthal, who's a President Emeritus of the Intelligence and Security Academy and a professor at the Johns Hopkins University. He served as Assistant Director for Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, Vice Chairman for Evaluation at the National Intelligence Council, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence, and Staff Director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. And Dr. Lowenthal is the author of the Standard College Graduate School textbook on intelligence, Intelligence from Secrets to Policy, now in its sixth edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Lowenthal.
Thanks. Just let me update you. It's now in its eighth edition, and I'm working on the ninth.
So, Mark, a lot of, since the White House announced that it didn't have complete confidence in reporting from the intelligence community about Russians paying bounty to the Taliban to kill American soldiers, much of the right-wing press, of course, has been making hay out of that, particularly attacking the New York Times. But it's, from what I can tell, it's not really unusual. First of all, in the intelligence world, as far as I know, you don't have sort of evidence that you could go to court with necessarily. And there are different intelligence services weighing in here, and it looks as if the NSA, the Signals Intelligence Organization, didn't have confidence, or they didn't have a smoking gun. But the CIA had confidence from interviews with Taliban prisoners. And so it seems that this is just business as usual in the intelligence community, where you have low, moderate, high confidence, and different agencies have low, moderate, high, and you kind of aggregated. Is that how it works?
That's pretty much it. I mean, each intelligence agency, I mean, some are analytic agencies, some are collection agencies, some are collection analytic agencies, and each one of them will have different focuses and different levels of confidence. It's this issue of, let me try and explain. So when you're an intelligence analyst, you're not only worried about what the material says, the content, but you're worried about how much confidence can I reside in that material. Is this something I want to take to the bank, or is this something that when I shape it for policymakers, I let them know, look, this one's a bit iffy. One of the things I always teach analysts, and I still teach analysts, is that the thing that you really want to get across to your reader, to your policymaker, is your uncertainty, not your certainty, your uncertainty, because they're going to make decisions based on your paper. And if you overwrite it, if you're more confident than your intelligence allows, they will make a bad decision, and that's your fault.
So from what we can tell here, that this information came from prisoners and detainees who were linked to a criminal militant network that was linked to the Taliban. And that's one of the reasons why there was moderate to low confidence, obviously. But in the intelligence world, the kind of people that you deal with to get information usually are pretty unsavory anyway, aren't they?
I was explaining to my class the other night, you know, when we captured Carlos the Jackal, we captured him because one of his lieutenants ratted on him. I mean, when I was on the intelligence committee, my chairman said to another member, you don't contact Mother Teresa to arrest the terrorist. I mean, these are the people some of the people you're dealing with are fine, but other times you're dealing with these people who are sketchy, to say the least, who have their own agendas. And that's why you spend time trying to assess the intelligence and also asking yourself, is there a deception? Are they lying? Are they telling me something which they think I want to hear it? So you spend a lot of time on this, and then you make an analytic judgment. But as you said at the beginning, Ian, it's not locked down. It's not like evidence. Look, I have your fingerprints on the gun. We don't, gosh, it would be great to have that, but we rarely have that.
So what we know is that this criminal militant network that worked with the Taliban was headed by a guy called Rahmatullah Azizi. He fled to Russia on a passport supposedly provided by the GRU, the Russian Military Intelligence Agency. So my understanding is that what the White House is walking back is not so much that this is likely to have happened, this paying the bounty to kill Americans, the Russians doing it, or Russian intelligence doing it. But they didn't have enough confidence in it to sanction specific individuals in this recent sanctions package. Is that your understanding?
Right. I think that's right. I mean, you know, there was a lot of criticism of Trump in 2020 because he didn't do anything about these reports, and he didn't take it up with Putin. And he also said he was never briefed, and apparently he was briefed. But the Biden White House, which has been fairly straightforward about sanctioning the Russians, when it came up to this issue, they realized we don't have what we need. The confidence level in the intelligence had dropped. And NSA is sort of an interesting case, the National Security Agency. Their job is what we call signals intelligence, which most people would think about just tapping communications. And if they don't have good SIGINT, then they tend to be less strong on calling it. That's what they do. They look for SIGINT. In 2017, when the intelligence community wrote their assessment that Russia had, in fact, intervened in the 2016 election and had favored Donald Trump, the DNI, Jim Clapper, had high confidence. Chris Wray, the director of the FBI, had high confidence. And Mike Rogers, Admiral Rogers, the director of NSA, had moderate confidence. So, that, you know, NSA being the outlier initially is not unusual either, because they're looking for signals. They're looking for communications. And if they don't see it, they're not going to say, you're all wrong. But they're going to say, in the absence of good communications, we're less certain.
And, of course, SIGINT is not ambiguous usually, as opposed to human intelligence is invariably ambiguous.
People don't always talk in direct sentences. People may be talking in codes. Like, we know the terrorists will say things like, the wedding is tomorrow, which means the operation. I saw an article today in the New York Times that the resistance in Myanmar, in Burma, uses words about it's time to cook the biryani, which means get your weapons. So people will talk in codes. Also, people talk in foreign languages. So you have to translate it. And the translation may be off. They may be speaking colloquially. So even if you have SIGINT, if you have a communications, there is still, you have to translate it, exploit it, decide what it says, and it may not be that straightforward either.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Lowenthal, who's President Emeritus of the Intelligence and Security Academy and a professor at the Johns Hopkins University. He has served as Assistant Director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, Vice Chairman for Evaluation on the National Intelligence Council, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence, and Staff Director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. And Dr. Lowenthal is the author of the Standard College Graduate School Textbook on Intelligence, Intelligence from Secrets to Policy, now in its 8th edition, heading for its 9th. So let's turn to the other story involving intelligence, and that is the Biden White House has now released information that the intelligence community knew, actually during the Trump era, that the information that Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign manager, had given to Konstantin Kilimnik, who was his deputy working with him in Ukraine, and Kilimnik is believed to be an officer with the GRU, the Russian military intelligence, that this information was passed on to the Kremlin and appears to have been worked in coordination with the Trump campaign. In other words, this is collusion, the very thing that the Mueller report was looking for. So, and now they put a bounty on Kilimnik. I think it's $250,000, isn't it?
Yes.
So what?
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that there was an interesting interview, I think it was on Friday, on MSNBC with Andrew Weissman, who was the number two guy on the Mueller report, working with Robert Mueller. And he was asked about this new information, and he said if we would have had it then, when we were doing the report, it would have been the smoking gun we were looking for. And he also went on to suggest that the intelligence was available to him, but somebody in the Trump administration held back that intelligence. So what kind of a bombshell is this to you, Mark?
I think it's less than a bombshell than confirmation. I mean, if you read the Mueller report end to end, then it is a tough go, not because it's badly written, but it's just a lot in it. I mean, there clearly were, despite what Bill Barr said, there clearly was some sort of relationship going on between Trump campaign officials and the Russians. And this just proves that it happened at the highest level. The fact that it's Manafort is not surprising to me. I think the really interesting question is the one that you raised is, if this information was available, why didn't it get to Mueller's investigation? I mean, if it was in the intelligence community, I can't see them withholding the information. But if it somehow was in the White House, then that makes perfect sense to me. But so clearly there was collusion. It was very high up. Manafort was the campaign manager. So this business about, you know, the Russian investigation being a hoax, it wasn't a hoax. It was real. And some of the Trump people, you know, did it extend to Donald Trump? We'll never know. I mean, I've seen indications the reporting people say he knew. We'll never solve that problem. But clearly there was collusion between Trump officials and the Russians, or a liaison. And I think, you know, my sense is that Manafort was probably feathering his nest. I mean, he doesn't have the best reputation for being an upright business person. So everybody assumed Trump was going to lose. Trump assumed he was going to lose. So here's a way of, you know, trying to do something to help him win. And if he loses, then I just did the Russians a favor. I go back into business. So for Manafort, this is a win either way. It's kind of sleazy, but it's a win either way.
Right, but the question would be, Mark, what did the Russians do with this material? And we know that there was coordination because one of the more obvious ones was when, just before the election, the Access Hollywood tape came out, and that was damaging to Trump. And then within 30 minutes, the Russians, which apparently was organized by Roger Stone through WikiLeaks, dumped all of this stuff that they'd purloined from the Clinton campaign. And that took the story off the news. So, you know, when you think about what was Kilimnik gave to Russian intelligence, were very sensitive.
Well, my understanding gave them that the Gates and Manafort, which was both of them, Manafort and his deputy, passed polling data, some of which was, you know, available in the press, but a lot of which was sensitive polling data from within the Republican campaign. And that was very useful to the Russians, because it helped them shape their messages on social media. Now, what is it that people are reacting to in America? So what do we do to either foster that point of view or kill that point of view? Where are the places we want to place our messages? So when you're doing a covert propaganda campaign, or actually more properly, a covert influence campaign, which is what Putin's people were doing, knowing where to target, instead of just doing a blanket thing on Facebook, but knowing where to target, where to buy ads, what kind of ads to buy, what should they say, is a tremendous help. It helps you vector and refine your message to have the maximum effect. So polling data can be extremely useful when you're running an influence campaign.
And of course, this polling data was specifically targeting Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Minnesota. And one of the assets that the Russians had, it appears, was the Green Party candidate, Jill Stein. She was there in Moscow for the 10th anniversary of RT, sitting at the same table with General Michael Flynn and the father of Julian Assange. And she won those three states by more votes than Hillary Clinton lost by. And you can't say that's cause and effect there, but it certainly indicates that the Russians had their bases covered in various different ways. This wasn't just a one-off operation.
Oh, no, no. This was a very well-coordinated, well-planned operation. Say what you will about Russian intelligence. They are very good at this, and they've gotten better at it. And also, they have this phrase, this goes back to Soviet days, of useful fools or useful idiots, people who make themselves available to us for their own motives and don't realize they're getting the short end of the stick. And I think the Green Party candidate would fall into that category. Michael Flynn would clearly fall into that category. And some people argue that's where Donald Trump was.
Well,
so this is a Russian practice.
Well, I guess just in closing here, do you think there'll be more to come?
Oh, well, I think it's very likely. I mean, obviously they're going to keep investigating this. They're going to keep looking for more files. So I would not be surprised if more material came showing the further relationship between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence.
Well, Mark Lowenthal, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And again, I mean, speak with Mark Lowenthal, who's President Emeritus of the Intelligence and Security Academy and a professor at the Johns Hopkins University. He has served as Assistant Director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, Vice Chairman for Evaluation on the National Intelligence Council, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence, and Staff Director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. And Dr. Lowenthal is the author of the Standard College Graduate School textbook on intelligence, Intelligence from Secrets to Policy, now in its 8th edition. We're going to take a brief station break and back assessing the piling on by right-wing media and the anti-vaccine movement over the pause in the Johnson & Johnson vaccinations based on 6 people getting blood clots out of 7 million who received doses. But they beg you, wait, my name. I got one hell of a job. We're born for the U.S. of A. Got the responsibility of our nation's top security. But every night and day, I salute the flag and say, thank you, Jesus, because I'm a secret agent, man. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Naomi Oreskes, who's a professor of history and science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. She received the Young Investigator Award from the National Science Foundation, served as a consultant to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and was a consultant to the U.S. Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board. Her books include Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, and Why Trust Science. And her latest book out this week is Science on a Mission, How Military Funding Shaped What We Do and Don't Know About the Ocean. Welcome to Background Briefing, Naomi Oreskes.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be back with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I certainly want to talk about your latest book, but let's begin with the Declaration of Independence. We're all familiar with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It seems that we're reaching a point in the United States where life itself and the pursuit of happiness, which you cannot pursue if you're dead, is now being threatened by liberty.
Well, that's exactly right. And this is, in fact, the topic of the new book that I'm working on with Eric Conway right now, that we have so glorified, valorized, even deified the notion of liberty to the point that it's actually become irrational. Because what is the point of liberty? What is the point of freedom? Is to pursue our ends so we can have happy, satisfying, fulfilling, and prosperous lives. But the denial of science, the politicalization of science, has led to a situation where people's demand for freedom has so trumped all other considerations that it's now threatening not just our happiness, but actually life itself.
And according to the recent Monmouth poll, 1 in 5 Americans refuse to get vaccinated. But obviously the other problem we also face, apart from the pandemic, is gun violence, which we do just every day. There's another massacre, and there was just a couple of days ago another massacre in Indianapolis. Again, that is propelled and justified by liberty, along with this anti-vaccine movement.
Exactly. And of course, it's completely preposterous because, you know, any ethicist, any philosopher, you know, if you read John Stuart Mill or any of the great philosophers, none of them thought that liberty went so far that I had the right to kill you, right? No credible philosopher has ever thought that. No credible religion has advocated that, except in particular circumstances. So the idea that we should simply have the right to do anything we want, irrespective of the consequences, it's not an idea of liberty that Thomas Jefferson would have recognized. The important thing I think that we need to talk about now, and this is why Eric Conway and I have taken this topic up as our next project, is that the idea that economic liberty, or that liberty should trump everything else, particularly economic liberty, was actually pushed by American industrialists in the early and mid-20th century as a way to fight unions, as a way to fight progressive regulation of the workplace, as a way to fight environmental protection. And so the idea that this has become politicized in the last few years is actually not true. It's actually been politicized for the whole 20th century, and it's been politicized in a very deliberate and conscious way to make the American people think that freedom has to trump everything else, and particularly economic freedom. And we are now living and actually dying with the consequences of that ideology.
Well, but I know it's sometimes futile trying to be rational when you're dealing with ideology and emotion, but still, if you just take the idea of economic freedom in the context of the pandemic, the reason we are in such bad shape is because Trump refused to listen to science, listened to quackery, and kept thinking that if the economy tanks, which is his only strong suit, was the economy, because he screwed up everything else. So he basically wanted to protect the economy in his mind and somehow wish this pandemic away. Well, the opposite's happened. Our economy is in terrible shape. In China, they haven't missed a beat. You know, they're just humming along with tremendous output in GDP, which is outstripping us. So the whole idea of placing the economy over public health has not worked. It's backfired.
Correct. And I think that's something that we see through a lot of the rhetoric surrounding freedom, is that it creates a false dichotomy, either the economy or public health, or the classic one that we've lived with in our lifetimes, either the environment or jobs. And yet what history shows us, political history, economic history, social history, again and again and again, is that that false dichotomy is false. In fact, it's the opposite. To have a thriving economy, you have to have healthy people. And the economy doesn't exist as something apart and separate from us, just like the market doesn't exist apart from us. The economy is us. It's us, healthy, you know, with our limbs intact, working to do productive things. And when people are sick, when people are injured in the workplace, when people die in the workplace, this is bad for the economy. And we've known this for 100 years. I mean, the first chapter of our new book deals with the issue of child labor and workmen's compensation. And, you know, in the early 20th century, millions of people were killed every year in the workplace, particularly on the railroads. It was so bad that America experienced what everyone's forgotten this now, but in the early 20th century, there was something known as the accident crisis. And it was a crisis of workplace injury and death. We have this fact that I'd love to quote. If you were a young man born in 1899, you would have been safer when you turned 16 enlisting in World War I than going to work on the railroads. So we address that through workmen's compensation, through laws limiting child labor, because people recognize that the economy is us. And when workers are killed, when workers are injured, when people get sick, they cannot be productive. But we have lost sight of that basic fundamental insight in recent years in this country.
So this pause in the distribution of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has led to a kind of frenzy in right-wing media suggesting that, you know, they've seized on it, the anti-vaxxers have seized on it. And of course, Tucker Carlson as well on Fox News, who's been basically saying, well, I'll just quote one of his anti-vaxxing rants, "If vaccines work, why are vaccinated people still banned from living normal lives?" The truth of the matter is, of course, that six women have had blood clots. Two died, but that's out of 7+ million shots that have been administered of the vaccine. So one of the things that's really alarming is that at the state level now, there have been a whole bunch of what they call the vaccine Bill of Rights bills that the anti-vaxxers have managed to get the legislatures in a number of states, Wyoming, Kansas, Missouri, Minnesota, and South Carolina, to introduce these bills. So the anti-vaxxers are on the march. This J&J pause has given them, put some wind at their back.
Yeah, well, that everything you say, of course, is true, but I would phrase it a little differently. It's not really anti-vaxxers who are on the march, it's anti-government. I mean, if you think about Tucker Carlson, who you quoted, you know, what is his shtick? What is his argument that he's been making for most of his career? It's an argument against government. And if we think about the federal government's response, you know, during the previous administration, we think about the states like Florida and Texas that have been aggressively rejecting scientific evidence. It's not really about the science. It's not that they sit down and read the science and think, oh, you know, I'm not really persuaded by this. It's that they have this deep hostility to government, governance, especially the federal government. And again, this is rooted in an anti-regulatory ideology that wants to say the government needs to be constrained so that business can be free to operate as it chooses. So this is a deeply, deeply cynical and completely political position that is tied up with the whole notion of, well, it goes back to Ronald Reagan and the idea that government's the problem, not the solution. We have seen in so many ways since the Reagan administration how in many of our most important crises, government actually is the solution, or at least it's a really important part of the solution. You cannot address a pandemic without an organized, coordinated response. And if we look at the countries that have done much better than the United States in this case, the ones that have had much lower rates of sickness and death, whether it's you know, a liberal Western-style democracy like New Zealand, or whether it's something different like Vietnam or South Korea, all of these countries that have had better responses, better outcomes, have had a more coordinated, organized, centralized government response. Now, obviously, government's not the solution to all our problems, and it's certainly possible for government to be intrusive and overweening. But what we have in the United States is actually the opposite. We have a failure of governance. We actually have a government that's too small, not too big, and that doesn't respond adequately when we have these big coordinated problems, not just the pandemic, which is the obvious one that we're dealing with right in this moment, but also climate change, the issue that I've worked on for the last 20 years.
Well, there's no question that the connection between the anti-vaxxers and the anti-government people. I mean, the kind of stars of the anti-vaxxing movement, starting with that British doctor who's a complete fraud and has been exposed as such, but nevertheless, he's still out there, Robert Kennedy Jr., which is unfortunate, and this woman, Judy Mikovits, who did this Plandemic film, she's out there as well. And, of course, the guy that made the film, this fellow, Mickey Willis. Those two, interestingly enough, along with the founder of the American Frontline Doctors, which is a group of so-called doctors, most of whom aren't doctors, who are promoting hydroxychloroquine, and they're associated with this, the demon sperm doctor. But one, their founder, Dr. Simone Gold, she was arrested on the Capitol, on the January 6th assault on the Capitol, which, of course, both Mickey Willis and Judy Mikovits also entered the Capitol with the insurgents. So there you have it. I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
Exactly. And we see the same thing in climate change now. I mean, this was the whole topic that Eric Conway and I unearthed when we set out to try to better understand climate change denial, that almost none of it had to do with the science. And most of the people who were claiming to be scientists, well, most of them were not scientists at all. A few were scientists, but not climate scientists. Almost none of them had actual credentials in climate science. But what they almost all had were connections and affiliations with libertarian think tanks promoting what they would call the limited government principles or limited government ideology, and this sort of kind of extremist glorification of individual rights to a kind of, you know, reductio ad absurdum that we're seeing today now, where individual rights are actually leading, as we said at the top of the hour, leading to massive unhappiness and more than 500,000 American people dead.
So what happened, if you go back to the 1960s, and I guess maybe the Sputnik helped propel American science, but there was this sense that we were in a race and that science was our means of competing in the race. And scientists were respected and the government were investing enormously and schools were teaching science and respect for science. So what happened in the intervening decades?
Well, the argument that Eric and I made in Merchants of Doubt is that through, if you step back in American history, you find that in the 19th century, government was involved in science to a certain degree, but the federal government not so much. In general, science wasn't really viewed as the domain of the federal government. It was mostly either in the private sector or on the level of state governments, like state public health services. That changed in the 20th century primarily because of the relationship between science and warfare. So the World War II examples, like the atomic bomb and radar, are more well known. But actually, scientists started working in collaboration with the federal government very closely already in World War I. And by the end of World War I, it had become clear to military and political leaders that science could be really, really helpful, could play a very important role in national defense. And so that gets ramped up in a really big way during World War II. And at the end of World War II, we have the emergence of a social contract, often associated with Vannevar Bush and the report Science, the Endless Frontier, that says the federal government not only should, but really needs to support science because of all the ways in which science supports the nation, not just in terms of the military, but in terms of technological innovation, generation of employment, prosperity, public health, you name it. And that was the social contract pretty much, you know, with some details, from the end of World War II until the 1970s. But what starts happening in the 70s and early 80s is that scientists start discovering some pretty troubling things. They discover that economic activity as it is being practiced is actually threatening life on Earth. And the clearest example of that is the ozone hole, but also acid rain and the emerging evidence of man-made climate change. And when this happens, we begin to see conservatives, first the more extreme conservatives, the libertarians associated with places like the Cato and the George Marshall Institute, but then spreading really to the whole Republican Party. I hate to sort of damn a whole party, but kind of this is the facts, that it spread to really the entire, more or less the entire leadership, with a few exceptions like John McCain, more or less the entire leadership of the Republican Party, because these people's ideology stood in the way of them accepting the reality that science was showing us that we had these really serious problems like climate change and the ozone hole that were being created by business as usual. And there was no really evident way to fix it without some kind of government action, whether it was an international treaty, as we did for ozone, or sort of bilateral treaties and emissions trading that we did for acid rain, or the possibility of putting a price on carbon, which was the emerging idea to deal with climate change, or, you know, the UN Framework Convention. These were all government actions. And so the conservatives, the libertarians, the ideologues who refused to accept the idea that markets can fail and sometimes you need government to fix those market failures turned against science. And that is what we've been living with in this country for the last 40 years. And we've seen it in full display, as you said, in the last few months in the anti-vaccine response.
And of course, on Thursday, we saw in full display when Representative Jim Jordan was hectoring and Anthony Fauci with this like machine gun volley of ridiculous questions about how, when are we going to get our liberty back? When are we going to get our liberty back?
And, right, as and, science took the liberty away, as opposed to nature, as opposed to viruses that exist in the world and will never go away, and we will always need science and public health to protect us from these things that are just real things in the world. And scientists didn't invent viruses, right? You know, God or nature did. But that's something that people like Jim Jordan just cannot accept. And so then they have to blame the scientists, when in fact it's the scientists who are helping us figure out how to survive and be healthy.
So just in the last minute, I wanted to ask you about your latest book out this week, Science on a Mission, How Military Funding Shaped What We Do and Don't Know About the Ocean. A minute on that, if you don't mind.
Sure, of course. So as you know, I wrote a big book called Why Trust Science. But one of the questions that comes up in about all issues involving trust in science is it funding. Who's paying for the science? And how does that affect what scientists learn and what they don't learn? And so Science on a Mission is an attempt to actually look really closely at that question so we can have a better understanding of how funding structures do and don't influence scientific work.
Well, Naomi Oreskes, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Naomi Oreskes. She's a professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University. She received the Young Investigator Award from the National Science Foundation, served as a consultant to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and was a consultant to the United States Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board. Her books include Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, and Why Trust Science. And the latest book out this week is Science on a Mission, How Military Funding Shape What We Do and Don't Know About the Ocean. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Tucker Carlson, the top-rated propagandist on Fox News, is mainstreaming the racist replacement theory heard at the Charlottesville Tiki Talk March, "The Jews Will Not Replace Us." Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships, an internationally acclaimed historian, speaker, and political commentator for The Atlantic, CNN, and The Washington Post, and other publications. Her latest book is Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. And she has an article at CNN, The New Lies of the GOP and Tucker Carlson. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
Thank you.
So, Ruth, just to give a little background, I recall when the neo-Nazis marched with their tiki torches on the campus of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. At the time, they were chanting, "The Jews will not replace us." And frankly, I didn't know what they were talking about. But this has been mainstreamed now. The background of what they were chanting has been mainstreamed now by Tucker Carlson, who has given real life to this disgusting theory. He, on his primetime show, which of course is the number one rated show on Fox, "I know that the left and all the little gatekeepers on Twitter become literally hysterical when you use the term replacement. If you suggest that the Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate, the voters now casting ballots, with new people, more obedient voters from the third world." And this prompted the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, to call upon Fox News to fire Carlson, given his long, quoting them, "given his long record of race baiting, we believe it is time for Carlson to go." In turn, the Fox CEO, Lachlan Murdoch, who now lives in Australia, responded to the ADL by saying, no, that Mr. Carlson himself stated during the interview that, quoting, "white replacement theory, no, no, this is a voting rights question." Well, of course, they were saying that Carlson was rejecting replacement theory by saying that white replacement theory, no, 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 this is a voting rights question. Well, of course, he was reframing the replacement theory as a voting rights question, but he was not rejecting it. And that is clear.
Yeah, it's highly disturbing because this is something that's been the idea that demographic change is going to lead to the extinction of white people because, is very old. It goes back to fascism. And it's being weaponized now in every which way by Tucker Carlson. And it's something that used to be really more of a fringe theory of real neo-Nazis, like Richard Spencer would talk about it, and other people who don't have primetime shows with millions of viewers. And it's very disturbing, and it's just pure fear-mongering because the word replacement is a very strong word. And the idea, it's a concept that goes completely against democracy, where people who are not like you can coexist with them. This is the idea is the more people who are not like you who come into the country or just are already here and have babies, they will extinguish you. Somehow you will cease to exist. You will literally be replaced by them. So the choice of words is extremely important, and it's designed to make people feel there's an existential threat. And the voting part is one of the latest lines they're using, because the GOP is on the defensive, and they lost the election, and they realize they can only stay in power if they use tricks like electoral fraud, electoral manipulation. So the newest line is from Tucker and company is that the Democrats are trying to open the borders and the caravans and and encourage immigrants to flood in to kind of jigger and engineer a kind of extinction event so that they'll flood the country with non-whites and overwhelm white people. And this kind of rhetoric, I have quotes from Mussolini in the 1920s where he's saying the same thing.
Well, of course, Donald Trump gave credence to this despicable rhetoric back in 2016 when he claimed that he actually won the popular vote, which Hillary Clinton won by 3 million votes. He claimed he won the popular vote because 5 million invisible Mexicans voted. So the notion is that even though immigrants can't vote until they become naturalized American citizens, the claim is, of course, that they do vote illegally. And as you say, this is a party that's becoming, well, you didn't say it, but I think I can make the conclusion that this is a party that's becoming authoritarian. But it's clearly now has a fascist wing led by people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, congresspeople who have come up with this new platform. A quote from their platform: "America is a nation with a border and a culture strengthened by a common respect for uniquely Anglo-Saxon political traditions." And they have formed what they call the America First Caucus Policy Platform, which goes on to say, "History has shown that societal trust and political unity are threatened when foreign citizens are imported en masse into the country, particularly without institutional support for assimilation and an expansive welfare state to bail them out should they fail to contribute positively to the country." Well, and the document also goes on to say that any new American infrastructure, quote, "reflects the architectural, engineering, and aesthetic value that befits the progeny of European architecture." So that's about as racist as you can get, right? I mean, it's out there plain as day.
Yeah. And if you look at the language again, what they say, if foreign people, quote, "are imported en masse," that construction of language that somebody's importing them in huge numbers, it's designed to, the mind will ask, well, who's importing them? Well, it's the Democrats. And it leads, there's a cabal, there's a conspiracy to kind of change, to force this change of demographics, of culture. And the other word that is used a lot by Tucker and by these people also is this idea that dilution, and that these immigrants, and this is also as old as fascism, these immigrants are not going to assimilate, which goes against everything that we know about how America developed. Through mass immigration and assimilation, and lots of intermarriage and cultural mingling, that's how we are. But that they will not assimilate that they will also, their blood, this is, and only some of them, like the former representative Steve King, came out and talked about, you know, blood pollution, right? That their blood will dilute our pure gene pool. And this is just total fascist stuff. And they're not going to mix, and they're not going to assimilate, and they're going to take over. So again, it's just paranoia and fear-mongering. And they can pretty it up with this reference to European architecture and classicism, which builds on what Trump was already trying to do. He had an executive order where he was saying that the only buildings that could be built, you know, should have like traditional architecture. And fascist movements always want to imprint themselves on the landscape and reflect their traditions, their values and buildings. But
sure. Well, yeah, look at Albert Speer and Hitler. I mean, Hitler spent more time with Albert Speer, the architect, than just about anybody else of his disgusting coterie.
So I would focus on the fact that they see an opening, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, and they also, she knows very well how to get rewarded by extremism, and Tucker knows this too. Extremism is rewarded with more media attention. That's how it is, both from obviously Fox viewers and far right people, but also, you know, this is the conundrum of the mainstream media, because you have to pay attention to these things to call them out. They're very alarming, and yet then our whole feeds are given over to their ideas. Not that we're embracing their ideas, we may be rejecting and refuting them, but the right is extremely good at playing the system of media that we have to get attention. And so look at Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's become a kind of rising star in the GOP because she's taken very extreme positions, and she's also she stages political theater. Like before, she was in, you know, Congress with a mask that said, you know, she's being censored even though she's on C-SPAN and on TV, all this kind of theatricality, it's rewarded nowadays, and the GOP is going with it.
Right, and she's raising record amounts of money. And again, I'm speaking with Ruth Ben-Ghiad, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who's been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships, an internationally acclaimed historian, speaker, and political commentator for The Atlantic, CNN, and The Washington Post, and other publications. Her latest book is Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. And she also has an article at CNN, The New Lies of the GOP and Tucker Carlson. So this sort of new fascist wing of the Republican Party that has Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, who apparently is the guy that allowed the reconnaissance tour of the Capitol before January the 6th, they've been joined by Matt Gaetz. We all know about him and his problem with underage young women. And then, of course, Louis Gohmert of Texas is joining as well. But this poison has already infiltrated the Republican Party. On Wednesday, the GOP House member Scott Perry of Pennsylvania invoked this disgusting rhetoric during a subcommittee hearing of the House Foreign Affairs Committee on the root causes of immigration. And the idea that, in particular, immigrants from Mexico and Central America are parasites, which is clearly what the manifesto of Marjorie Taylor Greene is claiming. I mean, Mexican and Central American immigrants are amongst the hardest working people in this country. I mean, it's just outrageous. And then when you think about the replacement theory and this idea that Jews will not replace us, that was what motivated the shooter who murdered the worshippers at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. That synagogue was dedicated to taking care of immigrants. And that's why he targeted them, because they were taking care of immigrants. And that is, in a nutshell, this whole disgusting anti-Semitic theory that the Jews are replacing you with Mexicans.
Yeah, it's just what you see in history is that these same paranoid fantasies, they get recycled, the same conspiracy theories, of which one, you know, that is the Jews are in charge of everything, or they're, you know, liberals and left are letting, they're going to cause kind of socialist apocalypse, the borders will be open. These are things that recur in every right-wing authoritarian regime. They all, or you know, democracies being eroded like ours. they all use them as fear mongering. The idea that foreigners are coming over the border, but they're now see what there was always the very first things that Trump did. The first piece I ever wrote for CNN in 2015 about Trump was when he started, you know, attacking Mexicans and slandering them. And so there was always this attack from the very beginning, and he showed that that was something that could get him votes, and you could raise money off of that. There was a market for this kind of anti-immigration, and there's a long history of it in America. But now, because they lost the election, there's this, and they're trying to get it back, there's this new idea that the Democrats are engineering, that they are, they're not just opening the Biden's not just opening the borders. He's literally he's sponsoring or letting in illegally all of these people so they can vote and change the country. And this is the latest thing that Tucker is propagating, and it's very dangerous. We're still on this kind of wave of anti-Asian violence. Now there's going to be another wing of, you know, anti-Latino violence, and it's designed to also make people feel that America under Biden is unstable as possible, is a fearful, unstable place, and it's designed to create an appetite for a restoration of Trump's law and order governance. That's the longer-term plan.
Well, I recall during the run against Obama with Mitt Romney, where somebody recorded him at a private donor function where he hoisted a very familiar Republican canard that the Republicans are the makers and the Democrats are the takers. So it's already been in their kind of sort of subconscious, the idea that they're the true Americans and the Democrats, you know, get their votes from these interlopers and usurpers who aren't really, they're essentially parasites. That's the way they look at it. Now they've added to that, obviously, the idea that they're also voting illegally. That's Tucker Carlson's excuse for his replacement theory. He's saying, oh, no, it's an election issue. Well, it's an election issue only because you crazy, lying SOBs are saying that all these immigrants vote when they don't.
And I'd also contextualize this. So January 6th, the lawlessness of it and the fact that, 140 law enforcement and security people were injured and several were killed, this is a huge problem for the GOP because they're supposed to be pro-police. So all these things that they're doing now to upping this idea of the Democrats as lawless, of the Democrats as helping criminals and defrauding elections. Of course, it was already operative with the whole idea that Biden stole the election, stopped the steal. But they need to, they have a messaging problem. And so my CNN piece you mentioned about the new lies, one of them that Trump and Carlson and allies in the GOP are propagating is that January 6th wasn't violent, that Tucker actually said there were no guns there. And Trump said, no, there weren't, attacks on police. There were, quote, hugs and kisses, that the rioters were actually hugging and kissing the police. And so this is flipping the script and trying to make the violence go away. And where they have to admit there was violence, they're blaming it on Antifa. So they're casting about, and these two things, of course, are contradictory. You can't have no violence and also have the violence be left-wing. But together with this and then saying that, oh, actually, the future elections are going to be fraudulent because immigrants are coming in, to have that line going, they're casting about in every which way because they're actually on the defensive. So sometimes when a party is on the defensive, they do very aggressive things. And this part of this America First caucus is riding this wave. We'll see how that's going to play out within the GOP. It is a far right party. That's how I see it now. And if you look at it comparatively, it doesn't have anything to do anymore with conservative parties like in Europe or in the UK. It's a far right party.
Ruth, that has decided it would rather cheat than compete. So
that's right.
It's already on the path towards authoritarianism, if not totalitarianism. And we've been discussing the far right fascist fringe of this party that's getting all this attention and making all this noise. So in the last minute here, what can Americans do? These are the minority we're talking about here, but they're very effective and very loud. When is the majority of Americans going to make a moral stand and sweep these people off the headlines?
Yeah, it's a hard question. I don't know the answer because not everybody in the GOP is like Marjorie Taylor Greene. And although it's very true that traditional, like very moderate voices or centrist voices seem to have less and less of a place, it's also not clear that the entire GOP is going to embrace this extremism. It's been very, and this isn't good, it's symptomatic that so many GOP people were retiring. They decided not to run for re-election, some because of age, but others because I think they wanted out. And that's, if more moderate people retire or leave en masse and the newer ones coming in, because Marjorie Taylor Greene is new, this is a kind of transformation of the GOP also generationally in a much farther right direction. So how that's going to play out ultimately, whether the rest of the GOP is going to get on board, will also depend who ends up being the presidential candidate and also how they do in 2022.
Right. And guess who's a front runner for 2024 for the presidency, short of Donald Trump? None other than Tucker Carlson. Sorry to laugh, but it's just, we really are in trouble in this country. It is really shocking. I thank you for joining us, Ruth, unless you have a quick last word.
No. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who's been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships, an internationally acclaimed historian, speaker, and political commentator for The Atlantic, CNN, and The Washington Post, and other publications. Her latest book is Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, and she also has an article at CNN, The New Lies of the GOP and Tucker Carlson. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.